snuck off, I said, as the other kids began to give me dirty looks. Ain't no one know I'm gone. What are you doing? Each of the kids held a stick, the end sharpened, and had the look of someone with a secret. None of your business. Go back to the kitchens, Joe said, picking up a rock from the dusty ground and throwing it at me. The rock missed by a mile, but the one I picked up and flipped back at Joe didn't. It hit him right in the middle of his forehead, and as he cried out, I picked up another rock. Next person throws a rock at me is getting what for right in their eye, I said, shaking with anger. No one's going to throw any rocks, Jane. You should come with us. We're going to kill the dead. Zeke smiled wide and handed me a sharpened stick. While Joseph was prickly and hostile, Zeke was all smiles and warmth, the kind of person people like to be around. And he had the best ideas. It was no wonder Joe was so tetchy. Who would want to share such a wonderful brother with everyone? I took the stick. What do you mean, kill the dead? There's a shambler stuck in the bopwire. We're going to kill it. That ain't a good idea. As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I knew it was the wrong thing to say. But I couldn't help it. I liked trouble as much as the next kid, but this seemed different. Dangerous. We're going to kill it so that we can go on patrols with the rest of the grown-ups, Zeke said with a grin. No more chores for us. You can stay here, Jane. No one wants you tagging along anyway, Joe said. I set my jaw. Whatever Joe said, I was going to do the opposite, just to spite him. I'm coming. You probably ain't found a shambler anyhow. Oh, it's a shambler, all right, Zeke said. You'll see. We marched in silence along the line of the fence rails. A few of the kids began to whisper excitedly, but a single glance back from Joe shut them up real quick. My stomach surged and gurgled, roiling with hot dread. I'd heard Mama and the other farmhands talk about how the dead worked. How they came out of the brush, overwhelming the unwary and wary alike. That was what made shamblers so scary. Even when they were predictable, they could still surprise you. As we rounded the corner, a loud moan split the air. There, twisted up in the bopped wire, was a shambler. We stopped, and all the celebration and shouting died down real quick. I'd always imagined the dead as some kind of monster. Mouth gaping as they came to eat you. But the shambler caught in the bobbed wire looked almost normal. A white woman with long brown hair pinned up on her head, wearing a day dress of green linen. Her skirt was torn, and her petticoat showed through. Her eyes were the yellow of crookneck squash, and the nails of her grasping hands had been broken down, her fingers covered with dirt. Still, I recognized her. That's Miss Farmer. Her family owns Apple Hill Plantation, I said. Miss Farmer hadn't cared for me. She thought Negroes shouldn't be allowed in the house, since we were dirty. But she loved Mama's blackberry jam enough that she came to call every so often, when it was safe to travel. She ain't nobody no more, Joe said, poking her with a stick. The shambler growled and reached for him. Joe danced out of the way, much to the delight of everyone, even me. I ain't sure why we thought poking the shambler with our sharpened sticks was a good idea. But everyone started doing it, creeping in close enough to stab the creature and then dancing out of the way before her hands could reach us. The game might have gone on longer if the dead Miss Farmer hadn't managed to pull herself free. Bobbed wire ain't a long-term fix for a shambler wanting in to the plantation. Since they don't have any kind of survival instinct, it's no big deal for them to eventually pull themselves free of such an entanglement, ripping off great big swatches of themselves to do so. And this is exactly what the undead Miss Farmer did. One moment she was jammed up in the bobbed wire. The next she was stumbling toward us, half her dress and a good bit of arm skin left behind on the fence, which now listed to one side. Most of the kids, myself included, screamed and ran. I took off for the field of sharpened sticks, knowing that would slow the undead woman down. But when I looked over my shoulder, I realized that not everyone was with us. Joe was standing right where he'd been, not moving, frozen in the path of the dead woman and her gaping maw. The boy had always been a bully, and the thing about bullies is they never learn how to run like the rest of us do. So Joe stood his ground, sharpened stick at the ready, convinced he was going to kill that shambler. At some point in the woman's lunge toward Joe, he realized that a stick wasn't much of a weapon against the dead. But it was too late. Joe was about to be Shambler Chow, if it hadn't been for Zeke. It was Zeke that slammed into Joe, pushing him out of the way of the woman. It was Zeke the woman bit, sinking her teeth deep into his throat. It was Zeke that cried out like a wounded animal, trying for a few precious moments to push the much heavier woman off him as she tore away a great chunk of flesh. And it was Zeke that let out one soft, anguished cry as his life bled out into the dirt of Rose Hill. The sound almost indistinguishable over the noise of the dead Miss Farmer feeding. "Joe!" I yelled, and the boy looked at me, expression distant and caught somewhere between grief and horror. I ran back to where he'd landed, pulled him to his feet, and dragged him by the hand through the field of sharpened sticks to the safety of Rose Hill. As we ran back, we passed the patrol coming to put down the dead. I didn't stay to watch. I'd seen enough carnage for one day. They say when they got there, Miss Farmer had started on Zeke's face, and that two of the men vomited before they even got to putting her down and driving a nail into Zeke's head so he wouldn't come back. Mama gave Zeke a proper burning and gave Mr. Isaac and Auntie Evelyn his ashes. Joe ran off a few years later, presumably to one of the combat schools, and so their heartbreak was complete. Auntie Aggie clucking her tongue and saying, "Told you them twins was an ill omen." It took me a long time before I left the safety of the main house, and I never ventured to the borders of Rose Hill again. Not until I came to Miss Preston's years later. I learned two valuable lessons that day. One, the dead will take everything you love. You have to end them before they can end you. That's exactly what I aim to do. And two, the person poking the dead ain't always the one paying for it. In fact, most times, it's the ones minding their own business who suffer. That's a problem I still don't have an answer for yet. One of the finest parts of attending Miss Preston's is all the friends I've made. Mama, you would not believe the camaraderie and esprit de corps in these hallowed halls. Chapter 4, in which I dodge unwanted advances and engage in a bit of blackmail. I'm staring at the scenery outside the window of the pony, brain tangled in bloody memories and a few regrets, when Miss Duncan asks me, "So, Jane, what do you think?" I blink and sit up, suddenly quite conscious of the two pairs of eyes on me. "I'm sorry, Miss Duncan, I wasn't listening. What are my thoughts on what, exactly?" Miss Duncan gives me a polite smile. "On the reason behind the dead rising. Of course, we've all heard preachers insisting that it's our sins, of one sort or another, that have caused this plague upon our soil, but the country's best minds have been trying to ascertain a scientific basis. And they are quite divided on the cause and the reasoning behind it. I'm curious as to what you think." I clear my throat and nod. I'm wondering why science is a better discussion topic than politics, But I don't say anything because that would be entirely too cheeky. Miss Duncan is a strange one, always talking to Negroes like she cares what they have to say. But I like her well enough, so I indulge her question. Well, I have been hearing some folks talk on the subject, and I think it's a tiny little critter that causes the infection, you know? Like the same thing that makes milk sour. If Miss Duncan noticed my near admission to having gotten my hands on a medical journal, she doesn't show it. Meanwhile, Catherine stares at me with her mouth slightly agape. A tiny creature inside of the dead. What, like a mouse? I shake my head, feeling agitated and frustrated. No, not like a mouse. Smaller, like too small to be seen with your eye. Microscopic. I read an article in the Evening Post a few weeks ago about a man named Joseph Lister over in England. See, he had a whole bunch of patients dying from infections, so he started sterilizing his surgical equipment with alcohol. Catherine frowns. So now you're saying that we should all drink ourselves stupid to avoid being turned into one of the restless dead? No. Not like that. The alcohol kills the tiny critters, like cleaning the mess up with soap. Both Miss Duncan and Catherine are staring at me like I'm speaking in tongues. I let out a breath and fall back onto the unyielding seat. Never mind, I mutter. This always happens when I start talking about complicated stuff with people. In my head, the ideas are so clear and make perfect sense. But when the words come out, they're a mess. They might be looking at me like I'm insane, but the stuff I'm saying is true. That's the thing with me. Once I read something, I know it forever, whether I'm supposed to be reading it or not. Miss Duncan gives me another small, pitying smile. Well, Jane, that certainly is an interesting theory. We bump along in a decidedly uncomfortable silence. I can almost feel Catherine's self-righteousness swelling up and filling the carriage. I bet she can't wait to get back to her know-it-all friends and tell them how Jane McKean is a mad half-wit that believes in invisible creatures swimming around in our blood. The rest of the trip passes in uneasy silence. There ain't even any more shamblers outside the carriage window to break up the monotony of dirt and trees and the occasional farmstead. Finally, we approach the high stone walls of Baltimore. On this side, it's covered in scaffolding, and men at the top appear to be adding more stones and barbed wire. That thing's tall enough if you ask me, but I suppose you can't be too careful. We wait as the massive main gates of the west entrance are opened for us, and then pass into the city, the carriage letting us off at a central stop. The cobblestones are a nice change from the hard-packed dirt roads of the country. There are dirt roads in other parts of Baltimore, but this part of the city nearest to City Hall has nicer streets. I climb down, and while the rest of the girls disembark, I study the gates. They are monstrously huge. I heard tell that each one takes 3 strong men to open and close. The wrought iron is painted black. Red, white, and blue ribbons are woven through the bars. Nearby, a sign proclaims, "Come celebrate the 5-year anniversary of the construction of Central Gate on Rising Day, July 2nd, 1880. A project funded by Mayor Abraham Carr and the Survivalist Party. Dancing, food, and fireworks." It would be nice to go dancing, but that celebration ain't for me. No way colored folks would be allowed at a survivalist shindig. Not unless we were serving the punch, that is. Right before Catherine gets off the pony, she pokes me in the side. "I want my bonnet back right after the lecture, you lying thief," she says, low enough that Miss Duncan can't hear. She goes off to join her friends, a couple of younger girls who are just as well-dressed as she is. I scratch at the frizzy mass of my hair and watch her walk away. I'm feeling mighty out of sorts, and I ain't sure this day could get any worse. Hey there, Janie Jane. What you doing in town? I turn around, and coming down the walk toward me is Jackson Keats. I was wrong. It just got worse. Jackson swaggers up, his derby pulled low over his eyes. His light brown skin is more red than tan, which is how he got his nickname, Red Jack. Jack's a true red bone, fair enough that you know at least a few of his people come from Europe, not Africa. His close-cropped curls even bear a hint of auburn. I once met an Irishman with hair the same color. He weren't long for this world, seeing as how he got put down by a shambler, but I think of that poor fool every time I see Jackson. Can't help but notice you ain't been around lately, he says. Jackson runs the roadways between Miss Preston's and the city, and there ain't much in Baltimore County that goes on without Red Jack being involved, legal or otherwise. His blue-green eyes gleam. We missed you last Saturday, Janie Jane. I shrug and glance around. Miss Duncan is still occupied with the pony drivers, most likely arguing about the fee. Drivers always like to up the price of a ride after the fact. Everyone knows they're as crooked as they come. Most likely Jackson is here to collect his piece of the action. Well, I ain't miss you or your hoodlum friends. And I told you to stop calling me that. My name is Jane, not Janie. He grins at me, revealing a flash of gold tooth. Aw, now that ain't no way to talk to a beau. You keep it up with that sassy little mouth, I'm gonna start questioning your manners. I cross my arms. You ain't my beau. And he ain't. What we have together is business, not personal. Not anymore, at least. I dart a quick glance toward Miss Duncan, who is still dickering with the carriage driver. Scram, before you get me in trouble. Jackson puts his hands in his pockets, rocking back and forth on his heels. His gold watch chain catches the light at the waist of the brand new green paisley waistcoat he's wearing. It's fancy and eye-catching. Silk, maybe. And nicer than anything I've ever owned. He notices me noticing and gives a wide smile. You like it? I remember you saying green was your favorite color. It is my favorite color, and it does look very dashing on him. No doubt about it, he is a fine-looking man. But he's also a mountain of trouble, and there are lots of other good-looking boys that ain't running around on the wrong side of the law. You did not wear that for me, so don't try to talk sweet. I know you, Jackson. You were probably on your way to see some poor farm girl that you tricked into believing you were the deputy mayor of Baltimore. Don't try to rope me into your shenanigans. Jackson flashes me that wicked grin of his again before his eyes shift to something over my shoulder. I turn my head to follow his gaze. Catherine watches the two of us with narrowed eyes. One of the girls says something to her and pulls her attention back to the group's conversation, and I swear under my breath, look at that. Now Miss Big Mouth is going to tell on me for sure. I've got to get back. He grabs my arm, that devilish smile playing around his lips. Come down to the barrel house after you get back to your school. I got a surprise for you. I don't want any surprises you might have, Jackson. That is a lie. He's the one who smuggles me my news stories, even a book every now and again, in exchange for helping him with this dark deed or that one. So I do want whatever he has. But I ain't about to tell him that. He tilts his head, his smile fading, and a serious look taking its place. Oh, this you do. Trust me. I blink, because I ain't used to such solemnity from Jackson. I once saw him beat a man near to death, all while wearing a smile. I spy Miss Duncan heading back our way, and I nod. Not tonight. Tomorrow. The smile reappears, and he gives me a low bow. I'll count the minutes. I snort. I doubt you can count that high. He gives me a wink, and just as quickly as he appeared, he fades back into the crowd of respectable folk moving down the sidewalks, anxious to finish their business and get inside before dark. I move back to the knot of girls just as Miss Duncan rejoins our group. Her cheeks are flushed, and she wears an expression that says she'd like nothing more than to smack someone. That's what trying to deal with one of them carriage drivers will do to you. They're as frustrating as Jackson, but without the charm. All right, ladies, let's make our way down to the university. We don't want to be late for the lecture. Miss Duncan sets off at a trot, and we all follow her. Running might be undignified for well-bred ladies, but for a passel of Negro girls destined to work cleanup, it's just fine. Catherine falls back next to me, her face reddening after only a few steps. I glance at her out of the corner of my eyes and can't help but shake my head. She sees me, and her already sour expression turns stormy. What, Jane? You shouldn't have worn that corset. That thing is going to get you killed. This thing happens to be the height of fashion, but I'm not surprised you don't know that. Kate, I like pretty clothes as much as the next girl, but I ain't about to let them kill me. She sniffs and adjusts her gloves. It's Catherine Jane McKean, and you know that. Never you mind about me. Who was that ruffian you were speaking with? Ruffian? What ruffian? I'm afraid I don't know who you're talking about. She stumbles on a cobblestone, and I reach out to catch her, steadying her with a light touch to her elbow. She shakes off my hand and picks up the pace. That guy. With the natty waistcoat. Already Catherine is out of breath, and we've only gone a short ways. If we keep on like this, she's going to faint and end up splayed out on the road like a well-dressed corpse. I hop skip a little, falling back from the group. Miss Duncan, I call, doing my hop skip limp. I think I got a rock in my shoe. Miss Duncan half turns but doesn't break stride. Catherine, wait for Jane. You two catch up to us at the university. I wave at Miss Duncan in acknowledgement and hop over to a nearby stoop. Catherine is panting at this point, her hair half fallen down after our impromptu trot. Stand up straight, I tell her. You bend over like that and you're going to be kissing the road. She does, still gasping for breath, and gestures at my shoe. Well, get your rock. I snort. I ain't got no rock in my shoe. I did that so you could catch a breath. You get found out wearing that corset, you're going to be on kitchen duty for a month. Catherine takes a handkerchief and dabs at the sweat on her lip, her eyes meeting mine with a grimace. And why do you care? I smile. No reason at all. I'm just being a good Christian. At her look of disbelief, I shrug. Should we start walking? Catherine watches me for another long moment before nodding. I climb to my feet, and we make our way the few remaining blocks to the university in silence. Outside the imposing columned entryway of the school, the steps are already clear. I make to walk inside, but Catherine stops me with a firm hand. You never told me who it was you were talking to, Jane. That coarse-looking fellow. You know courting isn't allowed. I smile, showing all my teeth, and tilt my head to the side. The things Jackson and I used to do can't really be called courting, but Catherine doesn't need to know that. And now our connection is purely business, no matter what my heart might say every now and again. Why, that was no one, Catherine. just like you ain't wearing a corset, right? Catherine opens and closes her mouth a few times, but she's caught in a snare. So she says nothing and settles for storming up the steps in a fine flounce. I follow her a little more leisurely. Blackmail ain't really my thing. I prefer more direct kinds of sneakery, like lying and stealing. But I can't have Miss Duncan or any of the other instructors finding out about what I do with Jackson on the side. So this is what I'm reduced to. We live in a terribly ruthless world. I wish I could explain to you how fascinating and stimulating are the lectures that we receive here at Miss Preston's. But I'm afraid my descriptions will never do them justice. Chapter 5, in which I attend a very educational lecture. The Baltimore University of Surgery, Medicine, and Thanatology is located in a fine building, meticulously restored in the years since Baltimore was reclaimed. The entry doors are made of wrought iron and glass, and just past them, marble columns and impressive oil paintings of bearded white men line the hallways. Like Miss Preston's, the building gives off the feeling that important learning is happening somewhere, somehow, some way. Unlike Miss Preston's, there is no lively chatter or the tantalizing smells of supper. Instead, a faint, foul chemical smell and a cool, humid emptiness waft out from the main doors of the building. The tainted air is reminiscent of a tomb. It is not at all pleasant. Maybe that's why only men get to attend the university. What woman would want to spend time in such an awful, damp, smelly place? No learning is worth having to endure such melancholy. Catherine is at the large entryway, her progress blocked by a couple of rough-looking white fellows. They lean against the door, their expressions amused. As I get closer, I can see they wear the felted hats and long coats of the city police. Their mustaches are patchy, and even though they look stern, they're probably only a few years older than Catherine and me.
"Miss, I'm afraid we can't let you in without checking you for weapons," says the shorter one. He's got a sly look to him, like a fox promising to be good around the hens.
"The mayor's inside, and we're tasked with keeping him safe. So, are you going to let us pat you down or not?"
As polite as they're being, they must not realize Catherine is really a Negro. No surprise there. She's haughty and well-dressed enough to pass as the daughter of a man of middling political success. Catherine must have decided the same thing, because she crosses her arms and gives the guard that narrow-eyed look of hers. "I have already told you I have no weapons, and I will most definitely not let you touch me. Now will you please let me by? The rest of my class is already inside, and I do not want to miss a moment of the esteemed professor's lesson." The short one smiles, revealing a gap where his front tooth should be.
"Well, how about that? The pretty little lady here doesn't want to miss the professor's lecture."
He gives the other copper, who has a big gap between his front teeth, a bit of side eye before looking her up and down like a sweet in a display case.
"Sweetheart, what are you really here for? You a working girl? If you're looking for a bit of coin, you ain't gonna find anything but disappointment in there with those grandpas."
The two of them chortle a little, and Catherine flushes. An ugly feeling rises up in me. I may be a liar and a cheat, but I absolutely despise bullies.
Hey there! Ooh-wee! I bet this a humdanger of a lecture if it can get old Jelly Belly out of City Hall. They ain't serving food, is they?
I chuckle a little, then shuffle my feet in a little dance, and the cops stop laughing. They forget all about Catherine and push off of the doorframe and move over to me.
"What you doing here, girl? This ain't no place for your kind."
"That's right.
The taller, leaner cop looms over me, and I duck my head in a pose of mock humility. Behind them, Catherine draws herself up, a huffy look coming over her, and I shake my head just a little.
Why, I just looking for my lady. She's come here for this lecture, and sure enough I done lost her.
I shake my head like I am the dumbest Negro to ever walk the earth. For a moment I'm afraid it's too much, but there's no danger of that with these two.
Oh yeah? And who's this lady you're looking for?
Gaptooth moves close enough that I can smell his foul breath, and I'm wishing I had a pocket full of mint to offer him.
Why, the mayor's missus, of course. I brought her brooch, 'cause she don't like to go out without it. She got it from the Belle of Baltimore herself. That fool attendant of hers forgot it, and the house girl sent me out with it.
I paw at my skirts like I'm looking for something.
Now where did I put that fool thing?
I keep feeling around like I'm searching for something small. There's movement out of the corner of my eye, and I look up and scream, giving it all I got. The cops stumble back a little, reaching for their billy clubs.
It's the dead! I just saw one! Oh, Jesus, oh, Lordy, oh, good God above, please help me! Where's the patrol when you need them? This is why it ain't safe in the city, no matter what those politicians would tell you. It ain't safe!
I fall to my knees on the steps of the entryway and begin to pray, like I'm absolutely terrified. A few passers-by on the street look at me and then hurry in the opposite direction of where I point. I sob and even manage to squeeze a few tears out. It's overkill, but ain't no sense in doing something if you ain't gonna go for broke.
Shamblers in the city! Oh, what is this world coming to when even the city ain't safe? Ain't nothing but dead walking around in Baltimore, and we're all gonna end up joining them.
I shake my head in denial, like this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Here's the thing about me. I have always considered pursuing a life on the stage if this whole killing the dead thing doesn't work out. The police officers don't know what to do. Looking between me and the street where I pointed, their confusion clear. I look up from my praying and give them a look of complete alarm, widening my eyes till they near water from the effort.
What? What are you still doing here? Ain't you gonna go catch that shambler?
They look at each other and take off down the avenue in the direction I point. I jump to my feet and approach Catherine, who watches me with a scowl.
What was that?
Now don't go giving me that sour look. That was just a bit of acting. My mama always said the best way to get what you want from people is to give them what they think they want. They expected me to be stupid, so I used that to our advantage. I moved to enter the university, but Catherine doesn't budge.
You just lied to officers of the law, she says. And why were you talking like that? You never talk like that.
I shrug. Sometimes you have to live down to people's expectations, Kate. If you can do that, you'll get much further in life. Now quit dallying and get inside before they come back.
I push Catherine ahead of me through the fine double doors, anxious to escape before what passes for lawmen return. The lecture hall is inside and to the right of the main entryway, and we easily find our classmates. They sit in the last two rows of the room, the space reserved for Negroes. If the hall had a balcony, we'd be up there, but it doesn't. Directly in front of us are a few of Baltimore's educated colored men who teach at the City College for Negroes. I recognize a few of them from their visits to Miss Preston's. Most of them are survivalists, and I don't much care for their message of knowing one's place and following along with the natural order. Grow where you're planted, they say, while telling us what great futures we'll have, bowing and scraping for our white betters. Seems to me those enlightened men worry more about keeping the mayor happy than the plight of colored folks. It's surprising our class was even able to get seats. The The lecture hall is packed to the rafters. Toward the middle of the audience is a group of well-dressed ladies, their pale skin glistening in the heat. Their dark-skinned attendants are stationed along the wall, looking bored. Catherine eyes the white ladies, with their fine clothes and decorative fans. There is hunger in her gaze before her usual expression of disdain returns. I understand that look, though. Those ladies are the creme de la creme of Baltimore society, and their brightly colored dresses are the height of fashion. Who wouldn't want to be one of them? But that ain't our future. Ours is leaning against that wall, ready to give our lives for a few coins, should it come to that. In front of the ladies closest to the podium are the men. Most of them are large, their width an indication of their wealth, and Mayor Carr is largest of all. He's a big bull of a man, dominating the second row, wearing the red and white striped ascot of the Survivalist Party. Survivalists believe that the continued existence of humanity depends on securing the safety of white Christian men and women, whites being superior and closest to God, so that they might set about rebuilding the country in the image of its former glory, the way it was before the war against the dead. I don't particularly hold no truck with the notion, since being a Negro pretty much puts me in the inferior column. But people really seem taken with the mayor, especially those that are just as pale as he is. The only reason I recognize Mayor Carr is because his picture is in the newspaper nearly every week, the headlines proclaiming this victory or that accomplishment usually in relation to containing the Shambler threat and securing the Baltimore city limits. It's the survivalists that lobbied to retake the cities nearly a decade ago, the idea being that if the cities were safe, they could provide an anchor to regain the continent. But I don't know about all that. Mama used to say that a politician was a man that had perfected the art of lying, so I always read those articles with a certain amount of skepticism before turning over to the serials. The serials are the best part of the paper anyhow. Reading about adventures out west or the tragedy of fine ladies with lecherous husbands always makes my day. I don't recognize any of the other men around Mayor Carr. They look a lot like him, with their chin whiskers and pale skin and bold ascots. There are a few members of the Egalitarian Party in the rows as well, with their yellow and blue striped ties, but they are far outnumbered by the survivalists. I settle into a chair, perching on the edge, careful not to bump the gun strapped to my thigh. Up front, the professor, a bald white man with small spectacles and a florid face, has already started delivering his remarks. He stands at a lectern in the front of the room, wearing a suit that is several years out of fashion, rambling on about organisms and spoiled milk. When he starts talking about things like pathogens and disease transmission, I look sharply at Catherine, who is staring at me like I just grew an extra head. I give her a smug grin. Her sainted professor is talking about the same sciencey facts I did in the carriage. That gets me to pay attention.
So, these pathogens, or very small creatures, are transmitted from one victim to another through the bite of an infected corpse. Over the years, these pathogens have evolved, which explains the shift from the Gettysburg strain, which would turn the victim only after he expired, to today's dominant strain, which initiates the transformation in the victim only a short time after they've been bitten. We've taken to calling this the Custer strain.
He chuckles a little at his own joke, but when no one in the audience joins him, he clears his throat and continues.
It's named after Custer's stunning defeat in Cleveland at the hands of his own infected men, of course. Now, overseas in Scotland, at the behest of a doctor there, Mr. Joseph Lister, they have had great success with burning their dead, which prevents the corpse from rising after burial.
In addition, a few of our own local academics, including Mr. Irvington, have just returned from a sojourn to British India. There, the Raj has ordered the beheading of their dead, regardless of whether they've been bitten. This has kept the rates of infection from both the Gettysburg strain and the Custer strain very, very low. In addition, and more relevant to our discussion today, there is comparably less of the infection west of the Mississippi River, especially amongst the Indians. It's similar to what we've seen in the South with the Negro, where the plague often fails to spread widely within populations of colored peoples. There is considerable murmuring at this, and Professor Gehring smiles, his full moon face glistening. I lean forward and frown. Fewer cases of the Shambler plague amongst Negroes? That is a bald-faced lie if ever I've heard one. The professor wipes at his brow with a pocket square before continuing.
I personally believe that the low rate of infection amongst the red man and the Negro is a direct consequence of the fact that neither the Indian nor the Negro is as highly developed as their European cousins, and thus show some of the resistance to the pathogen that we see in animals. Many argue this is an indication that, as polygenesis proponents have speculated in centuries past, the Negro is descended from a species entirely separate from the European Homo sapiens, one more closely related to the wild apes of the African jungle.
The crowd stirs again, while a few of the girls from my school look at one another in shock. I've learned a bit about evolution thanks to the books and newspapers Jackson smuggles me, and the comparison doesn't sit well. I cross my arms, as next to me Catherine mutters, "He did not just compare Negroes to apes." I grimace. "Oh, yes, he did. I told you this man was a crackpot." At the front of the hall, Professor Gehring holds his hands up for attention, a benevolent smile on his face. His eyes scan the room, not even bothering to land on our group in the far back. I guess he pretty much figures where we stand on the whole nonsense, being beastly Negroes and all.
"Now, I believe this divergent ancestry indeed gives the Negro and the Indian a natural resistance to the undead plague. Not only that, but I am going to prove that a simple vaccination can increase this resistance, much the same way Louis Pasteur has vaccinated livestock against various diseases in France."
Catherine sniffs. Livestock. I know what she means. The more this man talks, the less I like him. The professor is feeling his oats now, and he struts across the stage confidently.
"And in order to validate this theory, I have prepared a demonstration that I am certain you shall all find fascinating."
At that, he gestures to the side, off stage. There's a creaking sound, and then a chorus of moans echo through the auditorium. It's the dead. They say once you hear the Shambler's call, you never forget the sound. And I don't know who they are, but they're right. It ain't a moan and it ain't a groan. It's a sound somewhere in between, mixed with the keening whine of a starving animal. I've been hearing that noise in the distance, past the walls of Rose Hill, since before I can remember. But the first time I heard it up close was the day Zeke was devoured. The second was when I was a little girl, sleeping with my mama in her big four-poster bed. The major standing over us with a look in his bright yellow eyes like he was about to enjoy a whole pan of cobbler. Neither memory is one I want to revisit, so when that sound fills the lecture hall, it takes everything I got not to jump up, whip out my revolver, and start plugging away at anyone that ain't looking right. But I don't. Instead, I dig my fingers into my thighs, biding my time so I can see what kind of foolishness this professor is playing at. The rest of the room ain't so patient, and several of the men in the front are already drawing their guns and aiming up at the stage, not waiting to see where the sound is coming from. but the professor holds his hands out in a placating gesture.
Gentlemen, please. The situation is completely under control. You may retake your seats and put away your firearms.
The creak-creak moan sound resolves itself into a colored man pushing a sheet-covered contraption. I can tell from the size and shape that it's a shambler's cage. They use them during roundups, which are usually in the spring after the first thaw. The risen dead will lie down during the winter, since, like most folks, they don't much care for the cold. The first few warm days of the year, the patrols will put out cages and tie a chicken or turkey or hog to the metal bars inside. Since shamblers can't resist living meat as they wake, they'll come out of the woods jamming into the cage. Once it's full, the patrols will close the steel door and set the whole mess on fire. It ain't fancy, but it keeps the undead from attacking settlements and multiplying like rabbits come the spring. This cage is on the smaller size, like the sort a farmer might use in his field, and once the man has pushed it into the middle of the stage, the professor pulls the sheet off with a flourish. Inside are three shamblers, two men and one woman, all white folks. Sympathy for them twinges through me. I ain't seen a sight like this in a while. They ain't decayed much, so they must be new turns. And it makes me feel a little maudlin to think that a few weeks ago they probably had lives. Families that loved them, jobs they didn't care for, petty grievances they nursed grudges over. Now they're nothing but yellow-eyed creatures out of a nightmare.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we have three specimens, all recently infected. I would like to thank our fine Mayor Carr for allowing me to utilize these poor souls, gathered from the outskirts of Baltimore County, for our demonstration before their disposal.
A smattering of uncertain applause breaks out around us, and a sick feeling sits heavy in my belly, like I just ate a peck of two green apples. But the professor ain't finished.
I'd also like to introduce you to my assistant, Othello, who will be helping me with my demonstration.
The colored man next to the professor waves at the crowd uncertainly. A murmuring intensifies, the room buzzing like a beehive poked with a stick. Under it all, the calls keep coming from the cage, and my sick feeling gets near to crippling. Catherine grabs my arm, horror widening her eyes. He is not about to do what I think he is he? Nothing that is about to take place on that stage is going to be good. I can feel it in my gut. I reach under my shirt for my penny. It's cool to the touch, despite being nestled against my skin, and I know that danger is near. A lady's attendant is always supposed to have a pleasant expression, but I can't seem to keep a grimace from my face. I shift in my seat, rearranging my skirt so I can more easily reach my sidearm. You need to be ready to get the littler girls out. I'm pretty sure this ain't going to end up well for poor Othello, and this time, Iago ain't going to have anything to do with it. Catherine gives me a confused look before nodding as she gets the gist of what I mean, even if she doesn't get the reference. Now that most of the chatter has died down, the professor has moved across to the cage.
Now, Othello here is going to willingly submit to a shambler's bite in order to demonstrate the increased resistance of a vaccinated Negro. Earlier this week, Othello received a series of shots which were painless.
The professor takes out his handkerchief and mops his brow once more before tucking it back into his pocket. I'm certain he ain't told the truth the whole time he's been up there, since he's sweating like a murderer in church. What is this man playing at? The professor continues.
This experiment is intended to ratify the prudence of our mayor's Negro patrols, which, under the close guidance of our excellent keepers of the peace, fulfill their role of service that God intended, keeping our city safe. Just as the undead plague is born of God's will, so also is the Negro's resistance. Vaccinated Negro squads make sense from both a moral and a scientific standpoint. I am confident that this experiment will also demonstrate that the Negro and the Native Reeducation Act is entirely unnecessary. The cities are safe. The controlled territories are largely secure. Why should our citizens pay to educate colored boys and girls to do a job they're already biologically equipped to do? And when our esteemed mayor finds himself in the district after being elected senator, the professor pauses for applause from the survivalists up front, I'm sure he will make every Baltimorean proud by helping to repeal the NNRA.
The professor smiles a little and inclines his head in the direction of the mayor and the man sitting next to him. Old Blunderbuss, as the newspapers call Mayor Carr, was the one that established Baltimore's Negro Patrol squads a few years ago, right after I arrived at Miss Preston's. Before he was elected, the squads had been integrated, but now few whites serve in anything but command roles. I suppose it might have been a controversial move if it hadn't been so successful. As Mama once said, keeping the peace in this country isn't that hard, as long as nobody important dies. I don't like this blowhard professor very much. I get the feeling his research is less about science and more about the mayor's impending run for Senate. The man gestures to poor dumb Othello, who hasn't left his spot near the cage, and I can't hold my tongue any longer. The Negro scholars ahead of us don't seem inclined to say anything, and I cannot just let a man commit suicide, even if it is in the name of science. I jump to my feet and clear my throat. Excuse me, Professor Gehring? Everyone turns in their seats, and a few of the ladies nearer the front gasp, though whether because of my terrible hairdo or because I dared to interrupt, I ain't certain. Either way, I have everyone's attention. Here's the thing about me. I ain't all that good at knowing when to keep my fool mouth shut. The professor turns to me, adjusting his spectacles. Yes, miss. I wave and smile large. Hi there, professor. My name is Jane McKean, and I'm a student at Miss Preston's School of Combat. Before we get to all the biting, I just wanted to say thank you for having us here at your esteemed lecture. It is an honor. The professor's guarded expression fades, and he gives me a benevolent smile.
Well, yes, of course. You colored girls are part of the future of our great nation, and it is vital for all Negroes to understand how important they are to the fight to save humanity. This is also why we have invited your Negro scholars and leaders here to witness such a momentous experiment.
Oh, of course, Professor, most definitely. I nearly choke on the words, because the men in the row in front of me are looking very uncomfortable. They know this lecture is a sham just as much as I do, but none of them are willing to stand up and lose what little standing they have with the mayor. Leaders, they are not. I swallow hard, my heart pounding in my throat. Now, I just have one question, and I was hoping you would answer it before you get to your demonstration. Next to me, Catherine grabs my arm and tries to pull me down, hissing at me under her breath. The Negro scholars in front of me are also muttering, saying some not-so-nice things about me. I ignore them. The professor laughs.
Why, go right ahead.
Well, see, in the event, however unlikely, that your vaccine does not have the desired effect, and Othello there turns, I was wondering what your contingency plan is. Have you taken the vaccine yourself?
Oh, most certainly not, the professor says, his already ruddy face going positively crimson.
Oh, well, sir, that is a problem, see. Shamblers are pretty strong when they first turn, and I can't help but notice that you don't have anyone at the ready to put the big man down. You do understand he's going to go after you first, don't you? The crowd shifts uncomfortably, and the professor forces out a dry laugh. Next to me, Catherine whispers, "Sit down, Jane," while a few of the ladies in the gallery exclaim over the rudeness of this new crop of Negroes. This was a bad idea. This is the worst idea in the long and storied history of terrible ideas, right on up there with Julius Caesar marching up to the Roman Senate when he knew everyone wanted him dead. Why did I open my mouth? Why don't I just learn to mind my place, like Miss Anderson is always harping on about? For a moment, my bravado falters. Maybe I should just sit down and leave Othello to his fate. But, along the wall, one of the girls catches my eye and gives a slight nod. I know her. Her name is Maisie Carpenter. She was in her last year of Miss Preston's, my first year there. Her silent approval warms me.
"Miss McKean," the professor begins, but he's interrupted by Mayor Carr himself climbing to his feet. "Girl," he begins, in his condescending politician's voice, "your concern for your betters is a credit to the fine training you've received out there by Miss Preston's. But you can rest assured that this demonstration is going to go quite as expected. That is to say, our good man Othello here will only experience but a little discomfort from the shambler's bite. There's nothing that I value more than the safety of the good citizens of this fine city, and Professor Gehring's work is a testament to the vision of the Survivalist Party and the future of these American states. It is men of science like him and brave patriots like Othello who will restore this nation to its former glory."
The mayor grins wide, and there is a smattering of applause in reaction to his speechifying. Then he makes a shooing motion in my direction.
"Now, why don't you take your seat? With due respect to Miss Preston, this ain't your place."
His words are mild. His tone is not. And what he says unlocks some long-buried memory. Just like that, I'm no longer in the lecture hall, but back at Rose Hill Plantation, watching as the major slowly uncoils the horsewhip from its hook.
"This ain't your place, girl. You run back on inside for your next."
I blink. This is where I cash in my chips. No way I can out-talk old Blunderbuss, especially now that my moment has passed. After all, he's a professional liar. I might be good, but I ain't no politician. "Well, Mr. Mayor, that is a relief." I force a shaky smile and bob a curtsy before sinking back into my chair. "You are most unseemly sometimes," Catherine whispers next to me. "Honestly, Jane, I don't know why you even bother with Miss Preston's. It's obvious from anyone paying attention that you'll never make it as a ladies' attendant. Why, can you just imagine? That big dumb fool up there is about to turn into a shambler, and everyone is just going to let it happen," I whisper curtly. "Do you really think I could sit back and say nothing? If Professor Gehring says, Professor Gehring just said you ain't much more than livestock, you really gonna put faith in that man's words?" That shuts her up, and I turn my attention back to the stage. The professor marches over to where Othello stands next to the cage, a matter-of-fact smile on the academic's face. Othello ain't smiling. He looks terrified, second thoughts and all that.
"Now, go ahead and stick your hand in the cage," the professor says.
In the audience, someone coughs, and the crowd is so quiet that it echoes like a gunshot. Othello just stands there, shifting his weight from foot to foot. He looks at the shamblers and then back at the professor, who clears his throat and gestures toward the cage. The shamblers are reaching through the bars, their faces pressed into the spaces between, their mouths agape.
Go on, Othello. There's nothing to fear.
His voice is kind and confident. Othello turns to the crowd, and for a moment, I think that maybe he's finally going to put a stop to this. Walk away and live out whatever time he has left in this world. That's when his shoulders slump, and he's